Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. One of the unexpected consequences of the COVID-19 virus is that it has caused damage to the heart in some patients. That's even many that don't even have a heart or didn't have heart disease before contracting the virus. Another concern is that many people have avoided going for regular checkups or treatments because they've been worried about contracting the virus. Joining us on today's Smart Talk to discuss COVID and the heart is Dr. Rhonda Lynn McLean, a cardiologist and the medical director for heart transplantation with Penn Medicine. Dr. McLean, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. McLean, COVID started out as a respiratory disease, or at least that's what we thought. Do we know why it affects the heart?
So the thinking is that the COVID virus binds to cells in the body that produce a specific enzyme called the ACE2 enzyme, and these cells are located everywhere in the body. However, they are primarily expressed in certain tissues, including the lung, the heart, blood vessels, kidney, brain, and the gut. And because this is so, there have been other sites that have caused comorbidities in those areas. And so SARS, also known as the severe acute respiratory syndrome, is what we know about, what we principally thought this virus was about. But because those cells that produce ACE2 are located in other places, you can get disease in other places.
You kind of anticipated one of my questions here is, are there other viruses out there that have an impact on the heart for, like COVID, some patients that didn't have a heart condition or heart disease beforehand?
Yes, there are other viruses that cause, for example, myocarditis, but they tend to cause myocarditis is a relatively rare thing, and they tend to cause it at a lot lower rates or a lower incidence than does COVID-19.
Myocarditis.
So if you take that word apart, there's myo, and that means muscle, card, and that's anything cardiac having to do with the heart, and then itis means inflammation. So myocarditis is inflammation of the heart. And again, there are many things that can cause it, viruses, bacteria, chemotherapeutic drugs that can cause it. But in terms of the viruses, it seems as if, and we don't have all the information that we need yet, but it seems as if the COVID-19 virus is much more likely to cause myocarditis than other viruses that we know that can also cause myocarditis.
I guess I have to follow up on that is, do we know why?
No, we do not know why. There are a lot of, as a part of this conversation, I'm sure that I will often say that this is a new diagnosis and we have a lot to learn. Because almost 28 million people in this country have been affected by a coronavirus infection, then I think that we will learn these things, but it's too new. We don't exactly even know what the true incidence of myocarditis is related to COVID, but in time we will learn these things.
Of those 28 million people, I don't know whether it's too soon to tell yet or not, but do we have a percentage breakdown or a ballpark figure of how many people of those 28 million have had some kind of condition, heart condition, or impact on their hearts as a result of COVID?
We don't have exact numbers. And I will say that there are many ways that COVID can affect the heart, myocarditis being only one of those ways. So in terms of myocarditis, it was thought initially that up to 30 to 40% of the people who were infected with COVID had some inflammation of the heart and therefore myocarditis. I think that that's probably less true and the numbers are much lower than that. Right now, the current thinking that is that it's somewhere between 1 and 7% of people who develop true myocarditis. But again, these numbers, like everything else, are in flux as we learn more.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Rhonda Lynn McLean, a cardiologist and the medical director for heart transplantation with Penn Medicine. We're talking about COVID and the heart. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. McLean, what exactly happens to the hearts of those who suffer damage after contracting COVID?
So in general, we know that adults of any age with any underlying medical conditions are going to be at increased risk for severe illness if they get COVID-19. So those include the heart-related conditions of having a prior heart attack, high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke. So those people are going to be at increased risk of severe illness. And then we also know that because the virus affects the blood vessels, then in the blood vessels, you can form little clots, and those clots can go to the heart and produce injury to the cells in the heart, causing essentially a heart attack. We know that when people are very, very, very sick, when they have severe infections, that too can affect the heart and make it so that the heart does not work as well anymore. We know that when we cut off blood supply to the heart, you can get arrhythmias where you have palpitations and the heart isn't working as well to get the blood around. And then we can have things like myocarditis, which is an overall inflammation of the heart muscle.
How unusual is it for someone to suffer heart damage from an illness when they didn't have a heart condition or heart disease beforehand?
It's relatively unusual. The vast majority of people who have a terribly severe illness with COVID-19 have it because they have background medical conditions, those heart conditions I mentioned, or being immunocompromised. There are people who don't have any underlying illnesses who do become very sick from COVID. We don't know why that is yet. Daunting part of this is learning who is, other than the people who have underlying medical conditions, who is at greatest risk.
So are we talking about permanent damage for these patients that have contracted COVID and then have an impact on their heart?
So those people who have who have underlying conditions and who contract poor heart function in that setting and in the setting of COVID have a very high mortality. So if you have had something wrong with your heart and you develop a worsening of heart function, your mortality, if you get COVID, is high. Your risk of getting severe illness from COVID is high. But for those people who didn't have underlying medical conditions, their mortality is less and they actually can get better.
We have a question from a listener, Sarah, who asks, does this newfound information suggest that overweight people could be at greater risk for the collateral effects of COVID?
So when patients are overweight, they tend to have other comorbid conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes. And so the answer to that is yes, because they are associated with those conditions.
And, you know, I'm kind of getting off track here a little bit, but it's related to that last question.
Please go ahead.
Well, one of the things that we've heard about those who are eligible for vaccines are those who are ill or have some pre-existing conditions. Would obesity be counted as one of those pre-existing conditions?
I'll answer it in almost the same exact way. People who are obese tend to have high blood pressure, tend to have things like sleep apnea, which then affects their hearts, tend to have diabetes. And so the answer is yes, if you have those conditions as well.
Is there a level of obesity?
Not that I know of. You know, there are categories of obesity, you know, including the morbidly obese with who have a BMI of greater than 40. And again, those people are just much more likely to have other comorbid conditions that would put them at increased risk of severe illness if they contracted COVID-19.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I want to talk about tomorrow's program. We have a pretty big program coming up tomorrow. Monday is Mentoring Monday. It's a women's networking event coming up, and we're going to be talking about that with Kate Barron, president of Pennsylvania Media Group, the Patriot News and Penn Live, and also Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Sarah Elizabeth Gaddam. She's a former CNN correspondent and reporter with the Patriot News. Women have left the workforce at a rate four times higher than men due to a shortage of childcare during the COVID pandemic. That's one of the topics we'll discuss tomorrow. Also, 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and his legacy. The editor of that book is Elizabethtown College professor Mike Long. We'll have Mike Long on the program. Also, what is causing gas prices to rise so much in the last couple of weeks and unfortunately supposed to continue to rise over the next few weeks. That's all coming up on tomorrow's program. During this portion of today's program, we're talking about COVID and the heart. Our guest is Dr. Rhondalyn McLean, a cardiologist and the medical director for heart transplantation with Penn Medicine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. McLean, we have a question here from Alexis, who is a student at Millersville University. She says, we've seen that COVID doesn't affect children as much. With that being said, are children and teenagers with an underlying heart condition still at risk for COVID or still not as much due to their age?
So that's a good question. It is true that a person who has an underlying condition at any age or who is over the age of 65 is much more likely to have severe COVID. But I think it's also important to say that while children and young people tend to have milder forms of COVID-19, they do get infected, they can get sick, and they certainly can spread the virus to other people. And they can develop, you know, myocarditis or any other complication, myocarditis, just like adults do.
Once there someone has developed a heart issue after contracting COVID, how is it treated?
So the treatment, for example, if your heart has been affected and the pump, the heart pump, is not working as well as it needs to, that is called cardiomyopathy. And I like to take the words apart, cardio being heart, myo being muscle, and pathy meaning pathology. So the heart isn't working as well as it's supposed to. So we have great medications for that. There's a host of different classes of medications from which we have to choose. And we know that those medications lead to less mortality. And so people can get have an effect of COVID on the short term, and people can have a long-term effect too. So we treat the all of these people who have a cardiomyopathy or who have heart failure with our best medicines. And the medicines are good, and people do tend to get better. But sometimes, you know, people do require support with intravenous medications. Sometimes people require mechanical support to support their hearts. And, you know, very rarely people can develop heart disease that's so severe that they require things like transplant.
Have there been patients who have had to have a heart transplant as a result of contracting COVID and having an impact on their heart?
Yes, not at our center, but at other centers. It's much more likely to happen with the lung, and people get lung transplants because of the severity of their pulmonary illness. But yes, that has happened.
We have a question from Abby who wants to know, will receiving a vaccine help to prevent the possible complications of a heart issue, even if the person still contracts a mild form of the virus?
We hope so. We don't have enough data on vaccines to actually tell us that, but that is the hope. With all of the, you know, organs that that can be involved, you know, including the lungs and the heart and the kidney, it is our hope that with vaccines we'll see a lot less of the effects, both short and long term, of the inflammation that's caused by the COVID virus.
Hey, Dr. McLean, I'm curious, and I hope I'm expressing this question correctly, but as you said, this is, you know, it's been a year, but this is a new illness. As a scientist and someone who, you know, there are new things that come along all the time, but what position does this put you in as a scientist, that there's so much that is unknown about this illness, about this virus?
You know, it does make it very difficult because we want to, you know, have a consistent message that we give to our patients and to the public. And it's harder to do as we're learning on the fly. You know, every day, every week, we learn something new. And as the knowledge evolves, the message has to be different. And so we have to, so that makes it very difficult for the patients because they have to sort of keep up to date, and we have to keep them up to date with the newest things regarding COVID, either treatment or, you know, who gets sick or vaccine information. And it's great to have programs like this to help keep people up to date. And that's probably one of the most challenging things that we face.
Has there been anything that has surprised you along the way in the last year about this?
That's a good question. I think that that, you know, kudos to our scientists who were able to get a vaccine online as quickly as they did. I found that surprising and heartening. And you know, I find that, you know, with the number of people who are working on this, I think that we're making much larger strides than I would have thought that we would have. So the things that I'm surprised about, I'm definitely happy about and encouraged about as well.
Let's take a phone call from Mike in Camp Hill. Mike, you're on Smart Talk.
Thank you, and a good program. Thanks a lot. I am 73, and I have a heart condition that is very mild, five stents, no other surgery. And I do have very mild COPD. So my question is, with these new strains of the virus, particularly South Africa, but also UK, I heard your answer earlier about protection for somebody like me. It's not sure. You hope it's good, but you're not sure. Once, and I have been vaccinated once, and I will be a second time in the first week of March. Once I've been vaccinated a second time, what can you tell me about how much protection you think I have from the UK and the South Africa virus?
Mike, good question. Dr. McLean?
Great question. And again, I'm in the position of saying that we don't know. We know that, you know, it's likely that you will have some protection from it, but, you know, viruses do what they do. And, you know, they can cause illness and they can also mutate and make it harder for us to treat the exact variant. I can say that we will know in time how effective our vaccines are for the different variants that come about. I will say that I think it's great that you got your first vaccine, and I'm glad that you are committed to getting your second, and I do think it will provide you some protection. I don't know if it will be the 95% protection that's been touted with earlier studies, because it's a different variant.
Mike, thank you very much for your... go ahead, Mike.
When you think about what a person like me, and there are many like me, can do with two shots and then 2 weeks or 4 weeks, so talking like April 1st or April 15th, what can I do safely, or what would you say absolutely avoid? I'll wear a mask if you say you think I have to wear a mask, but I want to know what you think I can do safely, or what you think I cannot do safely at that time after two shots and 2 weeks.
You mean as part of, with the consideration that you have a mild heart condition?
Absolutely, yes. That's okay. My consideration.
Dr. McLean, what about that?
So I think that the precautions that people are asked to take are still quite necessary. I think you still wear a mask. I think you still are 6 feet away from people. I think you still wash your hands. And a part of that is because there is an unknown. We don't know that having the vaccines prevents you from getting a mild form of COVID and potentially giving it to someone else, even though you don't get sick. So we don't know exactly what happens to people once they've received the vaccine, and other people are not vaccinated yet. Not everyone is vaccinated yet. And so until a time when we have a good idea about how the vaccines are protecting us, and until most people are vaccinated, I think we still have the same challenge. And, you know, personal protection and the washing of hands and the keeping distance is not going to be any different.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. Dr. McLean, Trish has a question. Do heart issues only affect those that have extreme reaction to the virus, or does it also affect those who have had no reaction, meaning those who are asymptomatic?
So it is much more likely to happen to people who have underlying conditions and who have had severe illness. But it can happen it's rare, but it can happen to people who only had a mild illness.
From what I also understand.
And this is not.
Go ahead.
Yes. So this is not to scare people, you know, just because you have had infection with COVID-19, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, you have to sit and worry about whether or not you're going to develop myocarditis or heart failure or anything like that. These are actually relatively rare, but they do occur.
And along those lines, from what I understand, and I just want to clarify this, that there have been patients, in fact, I think I read about one in the Philadelphia Inquirer, that had COVID, recovered, and then weeks later was presenting with some heart problems. Is that accurate?
That is exactly right.
So how often does that happen?
So we don't exactly know. Our best assessment, looking at MRI studies, which help to look at inflammation, looking at biopsies of the heart, where we take a small piece of the heart, and looking at autopsy data. Our best estimate at the moment, and again, all of this stuff is evolving, is somewhere between, you know, 1% and 7% of the time that someone will have an actual myocarditis, and then even less than that, be very, very sick from it.
We have a question from Morgan. If COVID-19 causes increased heart issues that requires more medications to aid symptoms, will patients have to take these medications for the rest of their lives? And if so, how do you think that will stand with the increased unemployment rates and people not able to afford necessities?
Right. I think in answer to the first question, people can and do get better, and some people come off of the medicines that we're giving them to help support them. Okay, so that does happen. And yes, it is a problem. Hopefully, you know, the economy will get better. Hopefully, we'll meet the as yet unmatched challenge for our healthcare community that COVID-19 is. And that will be on better standing because, again, there's a short-term illness and a long-term illness, and we'll have to deal with both, hopefully, you know, with getting viruses on board with our newer treatments for COVID-19. We'll have fewer people who have those severe and life-threatening cardiac effects.
We're getting some excellent questions from listeners. Ken tweets, I had two stents installed in April 2020. Am I now considered at risk?
Yes.
So yes. Anything to do with the heart, you're now considered at risk if you have had any kind of procedure or anything like that.
So things like, you know, so stents are usually placed because someone has disease in the arteries of the heart. And so yes would be my answer to that. People who have had long-standing high blood pressure would be yes to that. People who have diabetes, yes to that. Most things that involve the heart and are subsequent procedures for the heart or surgery, those people would be at higher risk. They're not at the highest of risk. The people who are at the highest of risk have multiple things wrong with them. But yes, they would be higher risk than someone who did not have those procedures.
Earlier, Dr. McLean, you mentioned heart attacks. One of the mm-hmm. conditions, something that has happened to a number of people who have contracted COVID is they've had a stroke. Now, that's not necessarily related to the heart, but Is it, you know, we could have strokes that are brain aneurysms, that kind of thing. But what is it with strokes that are, what happens with COVID that is causing strokes with people?
Right. So it is, the brain is one of those organs that has a lot of cells that produce that enzyme ACE2. And so, and as well as the blood vessels. So what happens with strokes is that you can form a clot, and that clot can travel throughout the body and go to the brain and cause a stroke in that way. One of the first places that so there's the heart, and then all the blood goes from the heart. And one of the first places that the blood goes to from the heart is the brain. So if, for example, you formed a clot either in the blood vessel or in the heart itself, that clot could go to the brain and produce a stroke. The blood vessels themselves in the brain can also be affected, and you can get a stroke that way as well, because remember, the blood vessels too are one of the organs that contain a lot of the cells that produce the enzyme ACE2 that the virus then connects to, it binds to. So again, there are those organs that are at highest risk, including the heart and the lungs and the brain.
One more question, Dr. McLean. We only have about a minute left. Have COVID patients reported having issues with heart palpitations?
Yes. As I said earlier, that there are many cardiovascular complications that can occur in COVID-19. And one of those is arrhythmia, either the heart going too fast or the heart going too slow or the heart beating erratically. And so people can experience palpitations from that. At its worst, when people are severely, severely ill, and again, rarely, the heart can go into a rhythm that doesn't sustain life, and people can die from that. That usually, that something like that will tend to happen in the sickest of the sick, however.
Interesting conversation, and it's fascinating in kind of a strange and dark way of how this illness, this virus, can have an impact on so many aspects, so many organs in the body. Dr. Rhondalyn McLean is a cardiologist and the medical director for heart transplantation with Penn Medicine. Dr. McLean, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
This is a previously recorded segment of Smart Talk. Please do not call in with your questions or comments.
The paradox of long-term care staffing shortages amid reports of high unemployment is not lost on long-term care workers and administrators. With plenty of jobs available in the industry, one health administrator is asking how it is that the long-term care industry can meet needs so much help and the rest of the world is unwilling to provide it. Erin Vialli is a senior professional in human resources and a licensed nursing home administrator based in Pittsburgh. She's on the program with us today. And also Zachary Schamberg, president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. Erin Vialli, you wrote a column called "When Do We Get Our Rosie the Riveter Moment?" What did you mean by that?
So I am an administrator of a 197-bed facility in Pittsburgh. And as 2020 came to a close, I kept hearing about unemployment benefits ending. And what was this going to mean for 12 million Americans? How were they going to pay their bills? What were they going to do? And I couldn't help but think that that story was getting so much attention. And I didn't think that our story was getting much attention at all, that we were having a staffing crisis throughout the year of how we were going to cover our shifts, get work done in our facilities. So it just kind of, I called it the pandemic paradox. How could this be that in my world, we're having a staffing crisis, but in the larger world, there's an unemployment crisis?
Why do you think that paradox exists, that at a time when so many people are out of work and need jobs, that they're not coming and looking to work in the long-term care industry?
It's hard work that we do. It's very difficult. And this year, more so than any year, we, these jobs in our facilities are physically demanding, mentally demanding, and this year have been so emotionally demanding. While our patients weren't able to have visitors, our staff have been a shoulder to lean on, someone to cry with, someone to hug. There's been so much anxiety, as I'm sure you can understand, among our patients. So our staff have really stepped up to be there for them. And these are just very difficult jobs. So I think that my job, and Zach from the PhDA, is doing a great job of trying to spread the word of how rewarding it can be to work in this industry, because I think people have an idea that it is just very hard without realizing how rewarding it is.
But during the pandemic, what's been different during the pandemic? I mean, one thing obviously is that your workers have had to be concerned about their own safety. But is there anything, or what has been different during the pandemic as far as workforce?
Everything has been different. It has been, we had a staffing crisis prior. You know, there is a nursing shortage. There were already, it was already a struggle to fill some of these jobs, and the pandemic only exacerbated that. I'm very fortunate to work for ManorCare, which is part of the ProMedica company, and we were able to get so many resources. We, they made funds available for bonuses, to get contract agency staff in when we needed them. We had lots of resources from them. We had lots of resources from the PhDA. Zach and his team kept us abreast of the changes, which were daily. They updated our policies and our requirements and regulations very frequently. So that was a big difference for us. You know, testing at my facility, we were conducting 500 COVID tests every week. Just until this week was the first time we were able to cut back based on county positivity. So everything that we've done has gotten harder this year.
How many cases, positive cases, have you had in your facility?
Throughout, since last May, we've had 57.
What about staff?
24.
By the way, if you have a question or a comment for our guest today, talking about long-term care and staffing shortages in long-term care, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Zach Schamberg, who is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, representing long-term care facilities. Zach, we have spoken fairly often during this pandemic because from the very beginning, long-term care facilities have been hit hard by the pandemic. It took some time here in Pennsylvania to get to that and to get the help you need. And I we're going to talk a little bit about what help is still needed. But we've often talked about the staffing issue. And I think that Aaron mentioned it as well, that this was an issue that existed before the pandemic, in that you often, many facilities had trouble finding workers. Pay is not that great. It is hard work. It can be physically demanding. So let me put it this way. I think it takes a special kind of person to work in your industry. As Aaron said, it can be rewarding, but at a time when people consider their own safety, doesn't that make it even more difficult? I mean, it sounds as if there are a lot of issues going on here, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Scott. And thanks again for having me on. And you said it, you know, we have talked numerous times throughout the last 11 months from the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And no matter what we choose to focus on, whether it's what long-term care needs, whether it's the vaccine rollout, we always seem to come back to this issue. Workforce comes up in every single conversation that we have. And, you know, Aaron mentioned it, you just mentioned it, that even before the pandemic began in February and March in 2020, our sector was facing what I'll say is the most dangerous workforce shortage in the history of long-term care. And even going back to 2019, our then Auditor General, as we've discussed, Eugene DePasquale, released a report that was called Who Will Care for Mom and Dad? And it highlighted those challenges, not just with retaining our staff in long-term care, but more importantly, recruiting and training new qualified staff as well. So as we've discussed, this pandemic has exacerbated, it has amplified our workforce crisis. I would go back to months ago when the pandemic began. We saw staff begin to leave because of the fear of COVID, because they didn't want to get sick or they didn't want their family members to get sick. And we understood that. When staff are leaving today, however, we are routinely hearing the same three words: fatigue, burnout, and exhaustion. Because between the challenge of protecting their residents every single day and then adhering to the endless state and federal guidelines that continue to be heaped on this industry, we are beginning to see that mass exodus that we've always feared take place. And that's very concerning moving forward.
When you say mass exodus, give me a sense of what that really means.
Sure. More and more, our industry is relying on agency staff, meaning contracted outside staff members who are coming in on a daily basis and filling in the positions that we just simply can't. We had to, at the very beginning of the pandemic, the first thing we did with the Wolf administration was work with them to ensure that our members would have the necessary staff in place. So that included allowing flexibilities in job training, easing bureaucratic burdens to bring workers from out of state, and as we've spoken about, even creating what's called a temporary nurse aid program, which is a brand new position in long-term care. So it's gotten to the point where, and I think it's a good thing that we've had to think outside the box to address the workforce crisis, but we've had to create new positions. We've had to lean on state and federal allies to help this industry bring more workers in because we just don't have the pipeline available to ensure that not only can we care for folks today as we start to see the light at the end of the tunnel of the COVID-19 pandemic, but that we can't care for folks in the months and years to come, especially in the third oldest state in terms of our population in the entire country.
We have a question from Chris, who asks, what impact does the wage rate paid to long-term care workers have in hiring? If workers were found to be COVID positive, do they get 2 weeks paid time off to quarantine? Let's start with, there are two questions there, but let's start with wages. As I said, traditionally, the workers in your facilities are not making a lot of money. Is that a big factor in this? I mean, are there people who are looking at this and saying, especially now, that I could be risking my safety, my family's safety, and I'm not going to make it. It's hard work, and I'm not going to make a whole lot of money.
Yeah, of course. And let me tackle that first. So one is that for most of the providers that we represent, whether you want to call it hazard pay or heroes pay, those bonuses have been paid throughout the COVID-19 pandemic to keep folks coming to work and really to honor them for all that they were able to do to keep their fellow staff and their residents safe. But Scott, you bring up an interesting point, or it's the right point to address, and it's Chris's question that wages haven't kept up, and wages haven't kept up with other service industries like Sheetz, like Wawa, as we continue to lose workers to those companies and those other industries. The question is why? Why haven't wages kept up? And it's because, as we've discussed before, of the Medicaid program. And right now, two-thirds of all of Pennsylvania's long-term care residents in nursing homes have their care paid for by the state's Medicaid program. But as you and I have discussed, We haven't seen a meaningful increase in Medicaid reimbursement in Pennsylvania since 2014. The reimbursement for Medicaid controls everything that a provider can do, the investments in staff, the investments in care, and the investments in the facilities. If Medicaid doesn't keep pace with rising costs, which on average are about 2% per year, that doesn't give providers the opportunity to increase those wages and invest in their staff. And that's going to lead to even more of a crisis when it comes to workforce.
But Zach, there are long-term care facilities that are nonprofit, and there are those that are for-profit facilities. The for-profit facilities, especially, why can't they just raise rates on their own, or raise pay on their own?
Well, again, when two-thirds of all long-term care residents in those nursing homes, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit, when two-thirds of those residents are on Medicaid, and that is the single reliant payment for everything that a provider does. And again, I don't care if you're a for-profit or a not-for-profit facility. And it's important to note that for-profit facilities throughout Pennsylvania take the majority of Medicaid residents. They take more what I'll call Medicaid day one residents, meaning someone is discharged from the hospital or from their home to a nursing home. They are on Medicaid day one, when that is the single point of reimbursement for these providers, and it controls everything that they do in terms of those investments. And there's not ways to raise rates on other types of care or to have more reimbursement come in, then there isn't the opportunity to raise wages. There isn't the opportunity to invest in care. There isn't the opportunity, unfortunately, to invest in facilities. So really, at the end of the day, it all comes back to that Medicaid program and the investment that we choose to make or not make in it this year.
Aaron, second part of Chris's question, are workers, if they're found to be COVID positive, do they get 2 weeks off to quarantine, and are they paid during those 2 weeks?
Oh, yes. ProMedica offers 14 days, so almost 3 working weeks for if you contract COVID or if you quarantine for other reasons due to an exposure. So, yes, of course, to keep our patients safe, you know, isolating anyone who may have been exposed, of course, is a priority for us and making sure that they get paid.
Another question from Abby at Millersville University. Are there education reimbursement incentives or partnerships with higher ed to help fill these open jobs?
Oh, great question, Abby. Yes, this is the best thing I think we can do in the long-term care industry is promote our own. So yes, ProMedica has fabulous tuition reimbursement. We have student loan repayment programs because growing our own nurses is the best thing we can do. We have such fabulous, fabulous CNA caregivers. And to the extent that we're able, we really want to motivate those people to go to nursing school to get that next level of education so that they can care for our patients in other ways.
Zach, we only have about a minute left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. So you've called it a crisis, Zach. Where do we go from here? I mean, you say that we've had this mass exodus. What's next? What has to happen?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, we need to make that long-term investment in long-term care. That begins and ends with the state's Medicaid program. I think we need to encourage the state and to create more state policies to bring workers into long-term care. And that goes with an issue like a directive like loan forgiveness and creating less bureaucratic hoops to becoming a licensed nurse or an employee in long-term care. And at the end of the day, Scott, you know, we've spoken about it. Long-term care, specifically nursing homes, are the second most regulated industry in the United States. And the relationship between our providers on the front lines, like Aaron, and those who regulate them have to be improved. We have to make this a career that folks want to come to, an industry that folks want to come to. So collaboration has to take place.
Aaron Vialli and Zach Schamberg, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.